That is so fucking crazy. I
Oh,
just emailed Jason and Michael the and Doug the movie poster for What About Bob. Basically, Doug and Jason watched Lost in Translation, which of course is Bill Murray in Japan, where of course our two most famous atom bomb explosions are in Japan. Takes the idea that Jason found that Sophia, of course, Sophia Coppola, Sophia,
right.
is actually modeled Lost in Translation after Lolita. That like the names of the characters match up to like the guy who did the music for Lolita and all this like really interesting shit.
Huh.
So, in Lost in Translation, his name I think is also Bob. I haven't seen Lost in Translation in a few years, but they were referring
I'd
to him
have
as
to watch.
Bob.
I'd have
And
to
so
watch
then
it
I
again.
thought, wait a second, Bill Murray as, if it's Lolita, then Bill Murray is the pedophile Bob. And I thought about, I had been watching Twin Peaks, where the bad guy is Bob, who's molesting all these girls. And in one of the episodes of Twin Peaks, someone says, but what about Bob? And I couldn't get out of my mind the idea of, they said, what about Bob? And I couldn't get out of my mind this Bill Murray movie. So I've been keeping this in my head all this what time of like, why is Bill Murray coming up with this? And then to find out if Lost in Translation is a version of the Lolita story, that's actually this fascinating sort of through line. Do you follow that?
Yeah, no, completely.
Yeah, so
And
it's this fascinating through line,
okay.
and I just last night emailed them saying, there's something here in What About Bob, and you just fucking mentioned this obscure movie. That's crazy. I love it. I love
Lake
it.
Winnipesaukee? Saukee? Lake Winnipesaukee? I don't know. That's fucking what do you drink with sushi?
Wait, is that where they go in What About Bob?
Yeah, Lake Winnipesaukee.
Oh, that's really funny. Huh. Huh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I was just thinking something else too, and I lost it.
I
Sorry.
think we're gonna, now, of course, taking this another way. So who is Bob? Now think of it, just follow with Bill Murray for a moment.
Bob Eubanks. Isn't
Bob
that?
is interacting with Richard Dreyfuss, who of course gets on board the Moses, the Mount Sinai resonating spaceship in Close Encounters.
Right.
Right, Close Encounters is totally like, here's the,
Everything ready on the dark side of the moon? Play the five tones. That's the
Right.
line.
So now that's Richard Dreyfuss. And isn't Richard Dreyfuss is the other co-star of What About Bob, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I've spoken to Will Morgan about Bill Murray being essentially a dead man. That he's constantly re he seems to be resonating this sort of
Yeah, death therapy, Bob.
yeah. And he's, I mean, it's just insane. You look at him in Scrooge, in Ghostbusters, he's kind of seems to always be in this sort of other world. And we joked around that he's Bill Murray's actually dead. If you like sort of follow through his movies, he seems to sort of be a dead man.
Scrooged and shit, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So this idea of Lost in Translation, of him being, of course, where does in Twin Peaks, where does Bob come from? From the other place.
Oh, you know that Bob is actually the name of God in Scientology.
What?
You didn't know that?
No.
Yeah, I need to look. I keep burning all my copies of Dianetics or Diuretics at the fire. I do like a Repo Man ritual where, like, if we have a campfire, I always get out my copy of Dianetics and throw it in, and then talk about, a plate of shrimp. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm
Repo
not
Man. You know what's
well-versed in
everyone's into
Scientology.
weirdness right now? Books in all the supermarkets about flying saucers, UFOs, how the Mayans invented television. No, I don't read them books. Well, the way I see it is exactly the same. There ain't no difference between a flying saucer and a time machine. Everybody gets so hung up on specifics, they miss out on seeing the whole thing. Take South America, for example. South America, thousands of people go missing every year. Nobody knows where they go. They just, like, disappear. But if you think about it, there had to be a time when there was no people, right? Where'd all these people come from? How the fuck should I know? I'll tell you where. The future. And where these people disappear to? The past? That's right. And how'd they get there? Flying saucers. Which really, yeah, you got it. Time machines.
What is that
but from? Suppose you're thinking about a plate of shrimp. Suddenly, somewhere out of the blue, someone like plate or shrimp or plate of shrimp. No explanation. No point in looking for one, neither. It's all part of the cosmic unconsciousness. Repo Man?
I'm going to have to see this. No, I don't know.
Yeah, Repo Man, man. It's Emilio Estevez. It's a cult classic. But that's something that, like, those lines have, like, stuck with me over the years, like, so frequently. It's all part of a cosmic unconsciousness. It's like a lattice of coincidence that lays on top of things. He throws diuretics, which is a joke on Dianetics, into the fire, so I've always done that. But I had a boss when I drove a taxi cab for a few years that was way, way, way into Scientology.
Back when you were a taxi driver?
Uh-huh, and had done form and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
And he told me, he had actually made stickers that said, "Keep the lasagna flying, praise Bob." And I was like, "What's this Bob thing?" And he was basically telling me that Bob is the name for God in Scientology. So.
And he makes lasagna fly?
Yeah, well, it was that was his thing, I guess, was like, "Keep the lasagna flying." And praise Bob. But yeah, the Bob thing. And then also, what was it? Mom and Dad Save the World or Galaxy or something. There was like some cheesy ass terrible movie that had the ruler was named Bob, and he had these coins that said, "In Bob we trust."
Hmm.
I don't know. It's just another example of Bob being God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Huh. Huh. Now, of course, what I'm thinking is, if you took Bob, this is might be silly, but if you take Bob as lowercase letters, lowercase B-O-B, and then flip it like the hangman, it would be the hangman of pop. So the father god upside down would be Bob.
Sure. Yeah. We had an insane acid night last year where we were coming up and we were reading Hop on Pop together.
Oh, awesome.
And our whole thing centered around Hop on Pop. And because Hop on Pop deals with opposites. It's like play all day, something all night. It would go back and forth between
rock
the opposites.
Rock and roll all night, something like that?
Yeah. fight all night is what it said. It said play all day and fight all night. And it would have one picture of them having fun during the day and then picture them all pissed at night. And it goes back and forth like that. And then the fact that, you know, I mean, that's what happens in those states is the opposites become so clearly mutually interdependent, and you stop seeing it as like this, I don't know, as these, there's no gulf anymore, and that everything just starts to merge and becomes a single state, if you allow it. And so that was, Hop on Pop was perfect. And so, you know, I got into the whole sync thing with the pop and the bubble, that bubble sync that kept on occurring, you know.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you. Have you ever read 10 Apples Up on Top? It's another Dr. Seuss book, but it's written under a pen name where he's like Theo Van Geisling or something like
that. That's his actual name.
Okay.
So his name is Theodore Geisen, yeah.
I have to look it up. So I still don't think he used his real name, but it's anyway, it's Dr. Seuss.
Uh-huh.
I'll tell you right now, but it's 10 apples, motherfucker. I didn't want to do this, but 10 apples up on top. Let's see.
You're thinking Spiro and then tree.
Zach,
being
thank you.
Tree life having the apples that are
He writes as Theo Lessig, which is.
That's not his name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But his real name is Theo, so that's why I was confusing it. But I knew he was writing under a pen name. But 10 Apples Up on Top, you'd read it. It is intense that it is it, you know, you could take it as building your Kundalini, you're stacking your Sephiroth, however you want to take that. And then ultimately what happens is that these three characters, they put one after another after another. They're competing, the three of them, who can put more apples stacked on their head. And then each one's like, I could do three. And then the other one's like, I could do four. And then they go on. And then they all, when the three of them end up with 10, suddenly they stop competing. And when they all hit 10, they just like become fucking ecstatic. And they're just like, everything is amazing. And oh my God, we've got 10 apples up on top. And all three of them have it. And they're just fucking freaking out. And then,
I was 5 years old, but I just got a flash of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then everyone else hates them and wants to knock their apples down. And they're chased around town of everyone saying, take those apples up your head. And they're like, no, it's the greatest thing ever. And then you have this thing where they're being chased around town and they get chased to this apple cart. And then they all like smash into the apple cart. And you have this huge like 2-page explosion of like apples flying everywhere. And then they turn the page and everyone gets up out of the destructive chaos and suddenly everyone has 10 apples on top of their head. So this sort of order out of chaos, you have this thing where now suddenly everyone has 10 apples and they're like, oh my God, this is great. We didn't know. We're sorry we tried to knock them off your head. This is amazing. And everyone's just like this sort of epiphany singularity moment of everyone having 10 apples up on top. It's fucking incredible.
Right. Well, so I was reading Einstein's, I had a book of like Einstein's letters and stuff, and he goes into all sorts of cool shit. One of them is one world government and his feelings on that. And he's just like, if we don't have a one world government, we're all going to die. He's just like, too bad that one world government will be the result of most likely of one government or a few governments using their massive military strength in order to keep the rest of the world in place. But he was like, if we don't have one order, we're all fucked. But I was looking through all his takes on things, and it just became really clear that like the split in the atom was just like something we could use of his genius, right? But his work was unified field theory. His whole aim was unified field theory. It's the ultimate like apex of taking all the fields and syncing them up, you know, aligning. His whole thing was synchronicity. When it really comes down to it. And he felt that everything that he had should be enough. And so I was considering the fact that, like, I mean, I'm no physicist, but from what I gather, it's like people in physics and people in these fields, like, they all want to make names for themselves. They all have titles. They all want to have the next fucking thing. And I wonder if, like, since Einstein, we've just, like, skirted around, like, the core of the thing, because they're more interested in the side of what we can use, what we can physically do, than they are in like the point, you know, for the same reason that we build bigger and bigger fucking telescopes and crazier microscopes and simultaneously like ignore like the implications, meaning of the pattern itself. You know, it's like in Pi when he's like, it's not the numbers, it's what's between the numbers, it's the meaning. If you haven't understood it, then it's not for you, you know. I don't know. I wonder a lot about that in terms of specifically unified field theory. And, you know, in terms of this whole apple thing, it's like that's knowledge. That's like when the Da'at reaches a certain point, recognizes its own limitations, and the tree folds back into itself. And then, you have the thing operating in the way that it's supposed to. But then at the same time, I wonder about like, you know, Einstein himself and reaching a certain point and then having this explosion come out of it. And then out of that, you know, it takes a while for people to get what it was actually about in the first fucking place.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we have unfortunately, humanity has a dark history of doing this, of, you know, someone might have achieved Gnosis 2,000 years ago, and then it gets turned to this, you know, ritualized church that has forgotten at all the point of it, and they just use it as a power structure and everything else. And that's true of every, you know, basically every religious structure falls into that. And, you know, a government that was built to ensure freedoms or things like that turns into an authoritarian system. Ultimately, we keep forgetting what the fucking point is. You know, this is our dangerous amnesia here is we, like you said, we're extracting, hey, what can I use this for, instead of going, no, the point of it is, it's like, wow, this flower is beautiful, you know, and smells so nice. Oh, I know, maybe I can extract that and sell it as a perfume. Or how about you could just say, wow, that's a fucking beautiful flower.
Right. And so that brings back, what was the Sneed, what's the, Sneed, everyone needs a Sneed, the Dr.
Seuss book.
Yeah, the Lorax, the idea of the shell around the city, and then this is brings us back to the popping thing. But I was considering while watching the film that the shell is actually the clipote that's around the tree, and no one can see that the tree is like in a sense a dying tree, because they've built this substitute reality. And so the idea that the shell, that the clipote is the wall surrounding the city, and then you have the shell around the seed. I don't know if you saw the new Lorax movie.
I didn't see it. The CGI one? No, I didn't see.
Yeah, highly recommended. But if you know the story of Lorax,
yeah,
you know,
I know the book well.
Where you have the thing that's the beautiful thing, and then everyone, he wants to make a profit off of it, which is money, which is, you know, has no basis in reality. But anyways, it's the fantasy, and then the fantasy ends up killing the beauty of the thing. But, you know, they basically want to take down it ends with the wall coming down, which is like the bubble popping. And so in a sense, it's like if the clipote or the shell gives way, then people see what's surrounding you is fucking death. You're going to recognize what's sacred, and the thing can finally rejuvenate itself. So the idea of the tree rejuvenating is huge in Kabbalah. And so you have what's necessary is the clipote. They're the shit that everything depends upon, right? Like we were talking about. They're the world of shit that needs to be there. But at the same time, you don't want that world of shit taking over the whole thing. You want it in its place. And so you feed to it. And so you were talking about 9/11 being an inside Job.
Correct.
And then Job in the I believe it's the Midrash, maybe the Gemara, I forget, but he's supposed to feed the clipote from his rituals, and he doesn't do it. He wants to be too perfect, and in so doing, that's his big mistake is what's acknowledged there, and that the clipote ended up taking over his life. And so there's that notion, and so I don't know. I was
that's
looking at it
like, almost like you could try so hard to not. You know, it's sort of like that, you know, it's a shadow, I guess. It's like you're trying so hard to not acknowledge any imperfections that you end up being consumed by the imperfections that you're trying to avoid. Yeah, totally.
It's America.
Yeah. What do you mean? We're number one.
America forever. You know, I saw a bumper sticker that said America forever, and I was just like, huh?
The empire never ended.
Right. And so, and then you can get into the Republic becoming the Empire and how that happens at the flick of a switch, because no one's seen that it's already happened before the switch flicks, you know? So, yeah.
So we have what occurs to me. I had a thought the other day. You and I had a conversation a while back about, okay, if LSD is to the A-bomb, or I take that back, if the A-bomb is to LSD, then CERN is to blank. And it brings us back to that same question mark on Athena's helmet. You know, what is the next emanation? What is the next emanation of the cycle? And it occurred to me, I had this thought last night of like, you know, we look at all these guys doing rituals like NASA, and you know, people have asked why do, you know, the Deepwater Horizon and all these like oceanic businesses name themselves after Neptune and blah blah blah, you know, and it's like even what I was thinking, what's insane to me is the operation that got Bin Laden was Operation Neptune Spear, okay, which
the fucking Trident,
right? Well, the fucking Trident, and that's days after CERN reaches record-breaking levels. Now, so what does that have in common? Well, Shiva has the trident, or Neptune has the trident. So you see where CERN is at record-breaking levels, and then a few days later, Operation Neptune's spear, which of course is the Trident, kills the king of Osama bin Laden. So this is really interesting to me.
You know that the Trident is the Shin, right?
Right, right.
So the letter Shin, the Hebrew letter Shin, which corresponds to as a pictograph, it's the canine tooth, right? K being 11, 9.
Right,
nine,
right,
nine,
right,
nine,
right.
11, right. And then the whole thing with that is the judgment card in tarot, which pictures the three coffins opening with the resurrection. And then you have the archangel above them, who I believe is Michael. I believe that's who they say that is. But anyways, it's funny. I don't know if you got to see my Antichrist Superstar with Jesus Christ Superstar video. Did you ever watch that?
Yeah, I have.
So the guards, all the Roman guards have these tridents, you know, and I was thinking about the fact that the name Yeheshua, if you were to spell it in Hebrew, would actually be Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh with a shin in the center, and how it is that that's the judgment. And what does he do throughout the gospel? You wicked generation, you fucking, he just talks shit to the people, you know, to the Jews, you know. And I was just like tripping out on the fact that he's the judgment, he's the messenger, he's Quicksilver messenger service, and then meanwhile he's just like the judgment card full on. But then you have the resurrection and the judgment card, and how I was thinking about the fact that, you know, he's resurrecting, but then you have Elisha. He's a different version of Elisha from the Old Testament. And, you know, I don't know if you caught in the recent blog the whole thing I was putting about Elijah and Elisha, and that Elisha is his predecessor, is Elijah's predecessor, who he sees go off on the chariot and he's given his clothes or whatever. And then you have David Bowman plays the New Testament Elisha, which is kind of a joke because it's in the film Give Us Barabbas. Barabbas is the other guy side by side with Jesus, who Pontius Pilate is putting before the people saying, choose, will it be Jesus of Nazareth or will it be Jesus Barabbas? And they say, kill Jesus of Nazareth. But then Barabbas means, it's got Abba in the name, but then the first part was, I think it's the same as Baruch, which is actually my rabbi's name, but it's son. So you have son of the father. And so they're a joke that they're, these two characters are both the son of the father. And so it's not a mistake. It's like they put two Jesuses there, but then it's two Yeheshuas, you know, who are you going to judge, you know? And so I don't know. There's so many layers to it. And then the main character who plays Barabbas and Give Us Barabbas side by side with David Bowman, the actor Keir Dalua, whatever his name, Dalia, I forget the actor's name,
that, but yeah,
in 2001, but his co-star, who's Frank Poole in 2001, right? He plays Barabbas himself. And, I'm sorry. Is that right? I'm tripping. No. It's the fucking guy from Planet of the Apes who is the person who is trying. He's like the Minister of Justice in Planet of the Apes who's trying Taylor, Charlton Heston. And he's the one who says man created ape in his own image. And how he in Planet of the Apes is in the same position as Pontius Pilate in Give Us Barabbas. And so I was, and then he plays Barabbas. So I was, this is like all interwound, but what the fuck?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And of course, Heston being Moses.
And then Heston being Moses, who Jesus is another, extension of in the same way, right, with Elisha. But Elisha raises the dead. And so this was an interesting point, is with the justice card of the raising of the dead idea.
All right, check this out. Because I was mentioning the Osama bin Laden death. In the first Ghostbusters, okay, there's a scene where Ray and Winston are in the car driving, and they talk about, hey,
about Revelations.
They talk about Book of Revelations. Specifically, they talk about the sixth seal.
Yes.
Okay, and then the camera views, so they're talking about end of the world, Judgment Day. They go, Judgment Day, Judgment Day, Judgment Day. So here's your judgment card of the tarot. And then,
right,
they talk about the sixth seal. And then the camera zooms out and you see the World Trade Center. Now, Osama bin Laden, while I don't really believe that Osama bin Laden took down the World Trade Center, at least just going with the story here, is that I saw that smirk, but just come on. But anyway, so going with the story, Osama bin Laden takes down the World Trade Center that we see. So play that kind of in reverse. You see the World Trade Center and the sixth seal. Osama bin Laden is killed by SEAL Team 6. Right?
Right.
Right. So you have this sort of sixth seal, or the six seals. It's pretty interesting that you have that combination there. So, all right. So CERN, but I would take this back. So CERN, the week of, is at record-setting levels. They have Shiva at their door with the trident. Then Osama is killed by Operation Neptune Spear. It's fucking insanity. So you have this sort of weird crossover with this trident there.
Wait a minute. Go back. I'm sorry.
I was just saying, so you have this weird crossover with the trident there, right? Where Neptune Spear and Shiva, there's a statue of Shiva outside of CERN.
Right.
So Shiva has the trident and Neptune has the trident.
Which is a gift from India. Like, that's such a trip. They just, like, gave them this giant, huge fucking statue of Shiva. Like, go for it.
All right, well, here's what I was thinking. Oppenheimer, all things being equal, Oppenheimer, after the destruction, right, he's sitting there, okay, we're going to try and build this thing, and you could all be all idealized, we're doing it for the war effort, or we're trying to save America, or we're scientists who are trying to figure out how to split it, any idealized way you want to look at it. But afterwards, Oppenheimer, bomb goes off, and Oppenheimer goes, holy fuck, what did I do? And, you know, Einstein, you know, famously said, I would have become a watchmaker, right, all these sort of things. So,
Einstein said he's going to become a watchmaker?
Wasn't the Einstein quote, if I had known, I would have become a watchmaker?
How perfect is that? I am become time.
Exactly, the timepiece. Yeah.
Watchmaker. And then you have the watchman. And then you, oh, yeah.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Dr. Manhattan. So, and of course, in Watchmen, there's a scene where Dr. Manhattan is taking apart a watch. And they actually quote, from the I could pull up Watchmen, but there's a thing where they actually quote that quote of, if I had known, I would have become a watchmaker, or something like that.
Really? And the clockwork.
Right, yeah, exactly. So Dr. Manhattan being the clockwork man, you know, being the golem is the clockwork man. All right, so let me see, where the fuck was I? Oh, basically, my thought, though, is that to identify yourself with Shiva, not that Shiva's necessarily all bad, you know, destructive, it's creative destruction, but whatever. So I don't mean to put a bad spin on Shiva as a 100% thing, but to identify yourself afterwards is understandable. Holy fuck, what did I do? But at CERN, I feel like identifying yourself with Shiva before you do something is a very different thing than identifying yourself with it after. Instead of reflecting and going, oh my God, what did I do? It seems like to identify yourself before, what I thought of last night, that would be like me like going into like a Justin Bieber chat room with the screen name like Child Rapist 666 or something. You know, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like to pick a name, to pick this sort of destructive icon and identify yourself with it before you've made your big mark on society, I think is very, very different. And it seems to evoke a very strange set of, I don't know, you know, I don't want to, again, I don't want to jump to conclusions. I think you and I share that in common, is we don't want to do that. But I'm just saying it puts a little, like, I don't know, raises the hairs a little bit of, like, what the fuck? Why would you do that before? And then, of course, what I think is interesting is that the CERN scientists said, we don't really know what this is going to do. And there's a quote of one of them saying, we might open a door and we're not sure what might come through it. Which, of course, sounds exactly like, if your idea is that the Trinity explosion is the entryway for this disembodied spirit. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, if
yeah, no, I get completely.
Yeah, so like, if you're saying, hey, I might open a door into another dimension and something might come through, this is your fucking, like, you know, this isn't like some crackpot. This is like a guy from CERN going, well, we're not really sure what it might do. We might open a door and something might come through it.
Yeah, and then there is no Dana, only Zool.
Right. Yes, thank you. Exactly. You're opening this sort of, you know, Stargate or whatever you want to call it. But the fact that it's just fucking bizarre. It's just fucking bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I just go back to Ghostbusters, because in Ghostbusters, when they're looking at the blueprints for the building, they're like, wait a second, this building seems to be designed specifically for this ritual to bring something through. And then you look at the World Trade Center, and the World Trade Center had all these tridents designed into it.
Where? I'm not familiar.
Look, you could Google, like, World Trade's WTC tridents. Yeah, you're gonna see like the base, like the at the base of all the at the base of the two towers were these tridents that they sprout up at the base of the buildings and then rise all the way up the tower. So like when you're looking at the building, you just see these vertical lines, but if you take follow them down to the bottom, you actually see that they're all coming out of these rows of tridents.
Really?
And
you know, I don't know if you saw in the last blog that we did on Mask of God, or I don't know if it was last because there was another one with the eclipse or whatever. But anyways, the whole thing with the Om symbol, I was trying to find a representation of it. And I couldn't find it, so I just made it myself on Photoshop. That basically the parts of the Om symbol represent the upper part is Brahm of the first section of the three. And then the lower part is Vishnu. So you have the creator, and then you have the preserver, and then the back tail is Shiva. And then the crescent with the dot above it is actually the absolute consciousness that's transcendent of the whole cycle. So you have birth, growth, decay, and death or whatever as represented by Om. But then you have this like I that sees the rest. And I was tripping out yesterday on head, the logo for, I don't know what it is, some sports company or whatever, but it's like a flipped symbol on the top of Om. It's like the reverse of the absolute. And I was just, I don't know, because we went into this whole monkey business. So I don't know. It was just a little interesting blurb, but I don't know. I trip out on the whole there. I think that there's what happens is that there's a rationalization that happens in terms of the absolute if you consider the cycle, you know. So I don't know. Strange.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. So I mean, I have, you know, we take this kind of full circle. I mean, I have on my my first tattoo was essentially the Saturn. So my third was an Om on my left arm. Is I got, you know, basically after an LSD vision, I felt compelled to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of a thing of like, it didn't really make sense to me, like logically, but it just seemed like the thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the idea of if it is representing that same sort of creation, you know, creation, creator, preserver, destroyer sort of cycle, that actually makes me happy. It's like the idea that, again, I take a very positive view of the Saturnian cycle. I think that's it's important to bring it back to agriculture, because then you can see that it's not something dark, it's just sort of an observation of nature.
Well, if you can take the Cain and Abel story in the first place, you know, the take on it of agriculture, I'm sure you're probably familiar with that.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So, I don't know. I see that there's like you're splitting the crop, you know, with the fucking sieve, but then it's the same as like, you know, you're something else is you're separating something from something that doesn't work, you know. So
sure. And then there's the idea of, you know, reap what you sow, because, you know, the Grim Reaper, he's so again, it's agriculture, you're a reaper, you reap what you sow. So it's, you know, this is to me is it's only bad if you, I don't know, if you're afraid of you got bad karma or something that you're gonna reap something negative. But if you, I feel like there's a way to go into that same thing in a positive light and to basically, what are we growing here? We're all trying to sort of do something, trying to make something, and you can make something beautiful, or you can, you know, you could, sure, you could destroy and have the Lorax environment, or you could be someone who not only reaps, but is there to make sure that the next crop grows and make sure that there's something, you know, there's a growth, there's a rebirth inherent in it. And I think if you're nurturing something, then you, it's not, you know, to be okay with the sort of lack of permanence of it.
Okay. Have you seen Adjustment Bureau?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so that's a Philip K. Dick thing, and I don't remember putting it on our queue, on our Netflix queue, and my girlfriend didn't either. But anyways, we watched it last night, and, you know, it's based off of Philip K. Dick, and it stars Matt Damon, and it's the director of the fucking Bourne Identity or whatever. But that, yesterday, I was just thinking about Ellis, like LSD, and then I was like, what is Ellis? Is there someone named Ellis? And it was just coming up, and I look up Elis, and it's a city in Greece where the first Olympic Games were ever came out of. It's called, the place is called Elis. And alternative way is Valis. V-A-L-I-A-S is how they showed it, and I was like, what?
Wait, this city was called?
Yeah, the city was called Valis.
Oh.
And then... Why is Ellis?
And of course, I'm sorry, what do the Olympic Games have but the Olympic torch? So you're like Prometheus, like it's the bringing of the fire. It's that knowledge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I read your last post, by the way. Excellent point, you know. I'm not sure what it means, but yeah. The shuttle landing and the whole deal. And then you have the rings, and you have Lord of the Rings, and then it's obviously one ring to rule them all, and then that's the Olympic rings. It's pretty unmistakable, and then they're the different continents, and I'm sure you've seen the new advertisements for the London Games, where you have all the continents coming together into kind of a Pangea, and then it's basically the rings uniting.
Oh, you know? Haven't seen that. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, there's a weird fucking advertisement, and they kick over Big Ben in the process. It's like, what? The fuck,
so it's like you're creating your one world government, of course. But then at the same time, again, the equal and opposite reaction, you could also see that as the tree folding in on itself, as those Sephirods coming together is the same thing of
yes.
Bringing those Olympic rings together.
Well, this is the thing, is that they have this whole Zion idea. And Zion, if you look at the old text, is actually the void. It's nothing. And it's the point that is a transcendent point that everything else depends upon. It's like the eye of the storm, right? And the Shekinah is seen in the same way, that she's like the position that is no position. And so that's why there's this argument that's given by Hebrew mystics now that's not pro-Zionism, because it sees Zionism as its whole ultimate aim, like especially like, I don't know, Einstein was a pro-Zionist. You know, but that he had a different interpretation of what Zionism was meant to be, and he couldn't have predicted where things would be going. But they consider the state of Israel to be the state that was not to go with the program that the rest of the world went by. And this is very controversial and upsets a lot of people, is this one point. But the idea that them holding out and not playing the same game that the rest of the world was playing was where their dignity lied. And the fact that there is no time limit on this, and when it comes down to it, they were to be the ones that did not submit, and there, you know, and so that gets really tricky, especially in terms of the Olympic Games and the support that America gives to the nation of Israel, which 1946 was established, and before that, you know, Palestinians and Israelis used to, you know, fucking walk each other's dogs and take care of each other's children. You know, you talk to much older people who lived back then, and they'll tell you, you know, and so that's a whatever. It's controversy, but it's applicable in all of the stuff that we're talking about. So, yeah, I don't know. I was definitely tripping out on that. And then also Lord of the Rings with the whole Gollum deal. They call it him a Gollum, and he leads them to Mordor. And it's only, and it's, you know, at the end, he tries to stop it from happening. And so I was considering Gollum as a metaphor for LSD, actually. And basically that it serves its function up to a point. And what's interesting is if you read the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, not obviously in reference to LSD, but in reference to the aid of psychedelics in the old text, you know, it is a means to samadhi and will take you so far, but they don't consider it a means to, well, to use a Vedantic term, moksha, which is liberation, right? But to use Patanjali term, it would be kaivalya. So like the ultimate state of samadhi is not something that's aided. It's something that you reach a certain gravitation towards, and then it's up to you at the end. So in the same way with the ring and the mountain, you know, it's like this thing carried you so far, but then it becomes a burden. It like jumps on his back and tries to stop him from doing the final step. And so I don't know, I was kind of tripping out on all the implications in terms of, you know, what we're doing here, and for to come together, we need to come together one more time.
Yeah.
But then it's like there's this whole finality issue where it's like, how are we coming together? What was our aim again? Like,
exactly.
Was this really about, you know?
And I think, I mean, that's something, I don't know, just, I don't want to get into it, but on a personal level, I mean, I really sympathize with that of just trying to figure out like what the point was and not getting stuck in, you know, that it's not to met, it's one thing to have a trying period, but there's something else altogether when it's something that should be so easy is difficult, because ultimately I feel like the reason I think it should be easy is essentially it's sort of you had said it, you know, it's sort of that like victory by submission, the sort of like giving yourself to it instead of and that doesn't mean submitting to like some douchebag, it means submitting, you know, to sort of that bigger thing of that you already know the answers and stuff like that, that sort of inner knowledge. But I think also this idea of, you know, where it becomes a labor and it becomes a burden, we see, not to externalize it, but we see with the Olympic Games specifically, you could see these big rituals that they're, it's like as if these guys have gotten so superstitious that they're like, trapped. They're like really trapped. I mean, how much money must it cost to do these high-end rituals of, you know, NASA flights? And you look at the Olympic Games, even the Olympic Stadium, did you see their lights? Now I don't find the illuminated eye in the pyramid to be a dark symbol, you know, it doesn't scare me, and yet it's pretty fucking ridiculous. The Olympic Stadium, they have these giant triangular light things, and they're all just these giant, it's like the whole thing is surrounded, the entire stadium is surrounded with these triangular lights, and yet all the lights are in the top part of the triangle. So the entire Olympic Stadium is surrounded by fucking really goddamn in-your-face illuminated pyramids. Like, come on, what the fuck? Like, some, you know, I guess my point is not that it's, you know, oh, I'm, like, it's, I see a lot of people on the internet get scared by these things. It's not scary in that sense, but you got to figure someone is investing so much time and energy and money into making these things that there's the superstition must be such an incredible burden on them at the same time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I had a friend at this party talking about how somebody had put on the visuals, I think it was my friend Dustin who did it, put an Illuminati eye up on the top of the stage. And he was like, I'm on psychedelics, I don't want to fucking see an Illuminati eye. He was like, fuck that, dude. And I was just like, you know, I don't care for it, you know. I got to say, though, I had a friend who did visuals a while back who was taking, like, he'd have like the Pentagon fucking coming out at you, but then Rainbow Bright on her fucking horse, like running away from it and looking back and just like totally like, I'm like, I love it. You know, I like it when people can play with it. But then when it comes to like the next level of. Did you see the alien landing at? I don't know if it was the last Olympics or the Olympics before that or whatever, but that when they landed the fucking UFO in the middle.
Oh, you know yeah, I know what you're talking about. There was, and it was even the 1984 Olympics was.
Was it?
Yeah.
That's so weird. But anyways, yeah, the lengths that they go to to play with people's consciousness and the symbolism and everything, it's fucking unreal.
Right. But, now, this is what we go back to again, is like when we talk about the idea of things being veiled is, you know, the illuminated eye isn't a dark symbol at all. I mean, ultimately, it would be the illuminated eye, me. You know, it's like the idea of, like, to put this out everywhere, it would be, you know, find your pinnacle, potentially. You know, that's the power that could be the power of that symbol. Of course, it's not how it's being used. But this is, again, if we want to talk about the idea of veiled symbolism or misunderstood and perhaps misappropriated, that I would certainly see it that way. Is, you know, the symbol itself is very positive, but so is the symbol of, you know, the you know, words of Jesus or the words of you know, any prophet are all potentially very positive. And then you have a power structure around it that says, like, oh, we'll tell you what this all means. It means suck our dicks, give us money, and, you know, give us your country. Of course, that's not, you know, that's not what it means. But then if we associate those douchebags with the symbolism, then we start to think that all the symbolism is bad. And ultimately, the fact that every one of these institutions has claimed, you know, laid claim to so many of these symbols, we're losing. I feel like there's if we allow them to be their symbols, then we lose a part of ourselves, a part of our heritage. You know, like you look at like the swastika was a very positive symbol in the East. Hitler comes along and says, "No, this is my symbol," and now you see it, and it's the darkest fucking thing. If we let all these douchebags turn our symbols into dark things, I feel like we're losing a part of our sacred heritage.
Well, yeah, it's like the N-word, too.
Yeah.
You know, that sure got fucking flipped around to mean equal. If you look it up, it literally translates as lesser than. You know, if you say it, the implication is you're lesser than me. I have authority over you. Meanwhile, for how many fucking people? I'm sure there's more people that use that to mean you're my equal than there are people that use it to say you're lesser than me. And so, you know, there's something interesting there to do, just taking a word and realizing the description is not the described. The same thing goes for symbols. You know, so I don't know. I do feel that there's some extra energetic that happens when something is kept in like secret, the energetic around secrecy, so that if somebody feels that they're privy to a secret, their relationship to the symbols involved, the amount of imagination has an influence that goes beyond if it were more exoteric.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And so that's my main thing with the tree right now, is that if you have enough people looking at something in a certain way, feeling that they're privy to something, but then it's twisted at the same time, that gets a little weird. And it's also important to remember that the Bible itself, how long has it been that people have been literate and able to read it as widespread as they have? I mean, when the printing press came out, this is no doubt the first thing that we printed. We printed a lot of religious texts before we printed anything else. But at the same time, who had access to the Bible other than priests initially, and who could even read? And so we're in interesting times because everyone can fucking read. Are they motivated, or do they have the interest to like dig and gather information through these things that are so, you know, twisted up in the past with the winners who have rewritten the history as they see fit all around it? You know, so I don't know. It seems like the gospel story itself is actually something that there was an air of secrecy in up until relatively recently. Like, it wasn't much over the last 100 years that, like, people have really had access to read this themselves in terms of the general populace. You know, and with the Phoenicians, you know, they had their own set of interpretations for all the pictographs, and the public had theirs, and right. It was set up that way by pretty intelligent people who were, you know, getting pretty high. Egypt, you know, those people partook of the lotus, you know, the right. What if the blue lotus or whatever, and would crack open the fucking dung bowl and get the psilocybin out of that too. Like, why is that a sacred symbol? You know what I mean? Like, a dung bowl, it fucking get you high, you know. And these are the same people writing the choosing what the symbols mean in terms of the language, and then giving the public a different interpretation of those very same symbols. And so what do we see in Masonry? The same thing, which admittedly so. It's no secret. Albert Pike is very straightforward about that. The lower ranks have a different set of interpretations. The G means something else for them than it does for us and for, you know, whoever. So there you go.
But then, well, Albert Pike's an interesting... I was talking to... there's this guy, Frater X. I did his radio show. You know, his whole thing is that the Scottish Rite basically came in, and he says they are like the IMF. They came in and basically strong-armed their way into the Masonic lodges. But he thinks that their traditions are basically kind of what you were saying before, of like not acknowledging that there was another way. It's like saying our way is right, and they're trying to sort of co-opt and then circumvent the Masonic system. So he sees this sort of Scottish Rite, and you know, his experiences with it is that basically they've taken a lot of the York Rite lodges, put them into debt, and then said, okay, well then, you know, you can't pay us back, we'll just take over your lodge, and now all of you guys, you know, follow our system. And he's tracked how this is sort of taken over. It seems to me that this is the same idea of you can co-opt any system, or you can twist the meaning of things. Just to say that Albert Pike's meaning of things might not be... I mean, reading Morals and Dogma, a lot of it seems legit, and at the same time, a lot of it's like, that's your interpretation. That's like your... You can kind of tell the politics in what he's saying, you know?
Well, that was the Zeitgeist challenge, you know, about that.
Yeah.
The Zeitgeist, the website that came up after Zeitgeist, that was basically, we'll pay money to... They had this huge list of things that were stated in Zeitgeist. They're like, if you can find a place where it says this earlier than Albert Pike from a different set of texts, then we pay you money. And there's just like this huge list, and they haven't had to pay a dime to anybody because no one can fucking do it. And Albert Pike's explanation is that this is secret stuff that's passed down word of mouth. This isn't in writing. And so you can't know one way or the other, but at the same time, Krishna had 12 disciples? Really? Krishna was hung on a cross? Really? Where does it say this? Oh, Albert Pike. Other than Albert Pike? Fucking nowhere. Like, it's just this whole thing. So, you know, because they wanted to draw these, you know, crossover lines between these different characters. And there's certain ones that work, and there's many, many, many that just are nowhere other than in Morals and Dogma. So...
Right. This is syncretism, is how it's pronounced. You know, the idea of you're taking, you could do it with mythological figures and sort of unite them, but this is also an idea of you're doing this specifically to, you know, unite these opposing ideologies under something. So it's the idea of like, okay, well, you know, I mean, look, the Roman Church did it for how long? Oh, okay, you celebrate this day as your winter solstice? Listen, let's call it Jesus' birthday and everyone wins. You know, oh, hey, you know, you call it this? Don't worry. Yeah, we celebrate that too.
Yeah, well, there is typology. And I think that there's something to it in the first place, because things get communicated. So the information that you can extrapolate by taking two different characters, especially like in the different books of the Old Testament, in the first place, like you can do typology across it between, you know, Moses and Joshua, and then, you know, all over the place. You find where are the parallels, and what would you gather from that? And so that's the same thing we do with sync. We find these parallels, and then what's the information that you extrapolate from the places of alignment and the places of non-alignment? And it groups into it. You can kind of get downloads through that technique. But then there's another level of assertion of manipulation that's directing the consciousness, and to be aware of that, I couldn't overemphasize it's that important.
Precisely, and the other thing is that, like, I think we have to learn to do both. It's like, I actually was just writing the other day. You know, I was writing about Saturn and Kronos and Kronos, and the idea that they're two different figures. Now, from a historical accuracy point of view, you should know that they're two figures, and yet, from a sync perspective, sorry, there's construction in my head. From a sync perspective, that, you know, if you just know that they're similar resonance, that there's a similar resonance between these two characters, both with their connections. I'm gonna mute you. Go ahead.
Oh, I can't even hear what you're talking about. So.
Yeah, exactly. I was saying that.
No. I mean, I can't hear your construction. I hear what you're saying.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Maybe just because you're close to your mic and the construction isn't or whatever. I mean, someone's fucking sawing back here. I don't think you can probably hear that.
No, I can't. That's really funny.
Yeah. See.
Okay, awesome. Oh, awesome. Basically, I guess my point is that, you know, it's important from one, like, for a left brain perspective, it's important to know, yes, these are two different things, and we want to be accurate, and this way you can trace and you can see where perhaps manipulation happens. And then at the same time, you can understand from a synchro perspective, a right brain perspective, that, hey, you know, it's really not that big a deal. You could see how these are the same archetypes. You know, what they're expressing is similar enough. And then I think my thing is you start with a generalization and you make a sort of, you flatten your archetype so that you understand, okay, well, here I see this guy with the sickle. I see that, you know, he's Father Time, he's Death, he's also Saturn, he's Agriculture, he's Osiris, he's Jesus, he's all these things. And you can kind of lump them together in an archetype way. And then the important thing to do is break them back up and understand, well, okay, if you want to fine-tune it, you realize that, well, there is a distinction between these two, and then you can kind of narrow down your... To me, it's almost like separating the wheat from the chaff, I guess. It's like you narrow it down. So you say, okay, well, it's expressing this archetype. And you say, well, this archetype has 35 different subsets. You know, there's Dionysus, there's Bacchus, there's Jesus, there's Mithras. Which one is it? And then you can kind of pinpoint your way down and whittle down to a more exact expression. That's kind of how I think of it.
Right. So... I'm in a weird place in terms of the specifics of Babylon. So I'm kind of, I see that there's this kind of like, so across the globe, it seems like there's a lot of people on the same page of this aim. And I think that in the midst of that, there's a lot of different interpretations about what people want that aim to actually look like. And so I don't know, it's weird. It's like this fucking mandala. It's like there's all this energy going into the thing, and then at the same time they don't expect it to endure, and they're willing for that, and that's not a negative thing necessarily. I look at the seven-pointed star, and it's like, that is not a stable structure. Is that part of the point of it? Is that, like, part of its meaning? That because it's not a perfect vector metric and that all the lines aren't the same lengths, that it's an acknowledgement of that? And then, like, that the tree itself, as we see the tree, is collapsible. It's not a stable structure. Yet, it can be manipulated to be one. If it collapses into itself, and so is it, I don't know. There's a lot of sides to this, and so I'm considering it in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just reading last night, the idea that Plutarch about Osiris dying on the 17th, and they were saying for the Pythagorean system, the school, 17 was this abomination number. It was like they called it the barrier because it wasn't 16 is a perfect square, and they saw 18 as a perfect rectangle, but they saw 17 as this imperfect in between. And it's just really interesting to me because we, again, on Tarot, we take 17 is the star, is the seven stars.
Well, Saadi is not the star, right?
Yeah. So
So Hay, they turn into Hay, which is the Shekinah, which becomes the Emperor. He takes the Shekinah and puts it into the placement of the Emperor.
Right.
Or takes the Shekinah, which would be that, and gives that to the star. That's weird.
Well, I was wondering if I can pull something up that I wrote the other day you might find interesting. But it's really funny. When you were talking about like rewriting things, what I found myself thinking about was monks, and you used to have all these monks who, before you had a printing press, you'd have to rewrite everything. And if you wanted to manipulate something, there's your opportunity to do it. Okay, don't worry, guys. We'll take care. We're just going to make copies of everything. Well, if you want to, you know, that's your opportunity to edit. You know, even it was a funny thing I was reading about just regular old cartography, and it was the idea that people will sometimes like put their mark into things. So, like, there was some guy who was making a map, and you know, he puts a mountain that wasn't really there, and he calls it like Mount Richard or something. His name was Richard, so he just like makes this map, and everything else is accurate except for this one little detail that people didn't notice for a long time, that he just wanted to be like, eh, and this is my little touch. So if you're this monk sitting there copying day after day after day, you're probably going to go, especially if you're also a philosopher and you want to put something, you know, an interesting touch on it. But so I'm thinking about monks, and we've been talking about time. I just got an email while we're talking from something called Time Monk Radio asking me to do an interview with them, saying, yeah, timemonkradio.com. It's so funny. It's like, so here we are, and we are the time monks, I think. Okay. Here we go. Are you familiar with the Papus Tarot of the Bohemians cards? Like, it's an older version of the Tarot.
Is it like the Rider deck?
It's similar. It's very similar in a lot of ways, but there are notable changes.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen that. I never used it. It's not like
it's probably, this would probably be impossible to do without the visual. I wonder. Okay, I'm just gonna say this. I'm just gonna blurt it out, and then we can sort of make it make sense. If you imagine the Rider deck, the Hanged Man, it's his right leg that's up in the air, and his left leg is bent. So if
right, which is supposed to be the water symbol, because mem is water, right?
Well, here's my thing. On the Papus deck, it's his left leg is up in the air and his right leg is bent. So if you were to turn these hangmen straight up, they make basically the Papus deck makes a number 4, and the Rider deck, makes like a P.
Mm-hmm.
All right, if you can envision that, just imagine mirroring the Rider deck.
Sure.
Okay, now, on the same version, the same deck, their emperor is shown in side view. Okay, where Ryder makes him face front, this has the emperor side view. And the way he's shifted on his cosmic cube there, his left leg is down and his right leg is bent. So he's making the number 4 with his legs. Mm-hmm. So on that same deck, if you flip the hangman, he's making that same number 4. So the emperor and the hangman, their legs are in the same position. So it occurred to me that it's the emperor that's being hung in this case. The emperor is the hanged man. Now, on the Rider deck and on the Papist deck, the hanged man's legs are in the same position as the world card. Turn that hanged man right side up on the Rider deck, and then look at the world card. It's the same leg positioning. Her right foot is down, and her left leg is bent. And on this Papus deck, it's the same way. So this is sort of like the emperor and hangman are reversals of the leg positioning of the world.
They could be it's really straightforward. You have fire and water, right? But it's not just fire and water. It's fire and water as principles of Purusha and Prakriti, spirit and matter.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the interplay of spirit and matter, and what's controlling what. A really big thing that's emphasized, what Crowley considered the most important card in the deck, was the Ace of Discs. The reason being that he felt that there was a complete misperception of the meaning of the cards due to, in his eyes, most likely because of his particular kind of upbringing, of Christianity looking at matter as something dead. And he was like, no, matter is very much alive.
Correct, yeah. And
would reference Einstein a lot and all sorts of stuff. Oh, here's the Golden Dawn hanged man. Kind of crazy. And then you can see the triangle behind his head facing upward is, you know, the implication with the triangle facing downward above him.
Correct, yeah.
You could also say that the point that's here is why he's the hangman is because these two triangles are separated. Now, here's like an old, let me see if I can show you this, old pamphlet that was given to me way back when at where I stayed at Mount Madonna. But here you have these different, oh, is that the wrong side? Yeah, here. You have Purusha and Prakriti, right? So these two triangles. And you go up here, and then this is actually the they consider this Om is like the primordial vibration is when the two meet.
Is the hourglass.
Yeah, it's like the hourglass, and you have them together. But my whole thing with the hangman is that it's picturing it with them separate. And it's the same thing with the emperor. You're basically acknowledging that for these to be like what you refer to as the cards as a cut-up method.
Correct.
Is actually the tree itself. In the first place, is cut up. You're taking what would be a perfect vector metric, which is, you know, like I say, isotropic, right? Where you have every line in the thing should be the same length. Even the lines connecting the parameters, like everything should be the same length. And then you have what is popularized now as the flower of life, right? Or the seed of life,
sure, yeah.
Reproducing itself eternally. Which is actually the first part of Bereshit, which was pointed out by the Meru Foundation, the Holy Mountain Foundation, right? And so there's this whole weird thing of, well, if the tree is broken up in the first place, you're actually looking at the hanged man is the tree, and it's a different take on, well, what is actually ruling what? Is the supernal triad ruling over the seven lower spherot, or the seven lower spherot ruling over the supernal triad? And what I would put forward is that as long as the Shekinah, as the Malkut, is not united with Ze'er, then you have a situation where, yes, the matter is definitely ruling over the spirit, at least temporarily, in a sense. So what actually ends up winning in the long run is another issue. But in the meantime, you have Babylon. And Babylon does its absolute best to build itself in accordance with the higher will, because that's the only way that it can really go the extra mile. And so that is like the death instinct, and it's also the pleasure principle in psychology. But it invests everything into basically making a name for itself, or a shem for itself, to quote the Old Testament, right? So Babylon builds itself according to these parameters, but it's a mandala, and it's not built to last. And people in the know are very much aware of that. And everyone should be aware of that. But people are able to ignore it because that's what people do.
Have you seen the tree depicted as just concentric circles, Ein Sof in the center, and all the sephirods as concentric circles around it with one straight line through? Have you seen that image?
I believe so. I've seen. Are you referring to when they take the tree and overlay it with
the flower? Look in your Skype. I sent you the link here.
Okay.
If someone's listening to this, they want to see it. You can go to commons.wikimedia.org/wiki/file:emanation.gif.
Oh, that one. I'm looking at a watershed.
Oh, the watershed is actually, that's the Trinity River. That's where, you know, JFK is shot along the Trinity River. What I wanted to show you is that same river has, towards the south of the river, Palestine and towards the north of the river, what's called Rockwall. Rockwall.
This is in Texas?
This is in Texas.
Weird.
You seeing that? Yeah. Trinity River. So you have Dallas, Fort Worth, and then Rockwall, which of course would be like your Wailing Wall, and there's Palestine.
Weird. Also, that so Shekinah is where we get the term. So when you hear the stone that the builders rejected, that was originally an Old Testament term that was used specifically in relationship to Shekinah. Shekinah is the rejected stone.
She's being rejected.
Right. She's the stone in exile. That became equated with Jesus. And so this is where it gets interesting with Jesus as Mercury and then the Tiferet being Mercury and then turning that into the sun and then turning Jesus into the sun, taking the messenger as the source, right? And then that directs all the energy in this really weird way. But she's the keystone. So we say cornerstone now, right? In masonry, we always do this thing. You can see all the images of George Washington with laying the cornerstone and all this business. But originally, the keystone is if you have an archway.
Correct.
You're probably
familiar with this.
Yeah. I don't need to talk like a teacher, but you have this archway, and the stone that lies at the center of it is referred to as the keystone because everything depends on it.
Right.
And so they say the Shekinah is what everything...
Hold your structure in place, yeah.
Yeah. So it's this whole idea that the Shekinah is the keystone, and everything depends upon her if you want to have a stable structure, rejected.
Can I just throw this back to you? Because I know exactly what you're talking about, the idea of the keystone, both architecturally and esoterically, but if we're going to make that comparison, the same way that Malkuth and Kether are sort of built upon each other, could we not see that the cornerstone is the earthly foundation, is your sort of Malkuth, and your keystone is very much your sort of crown, that the same way that it's what holds the structure together, both a earthly foundation and a heavenly foundation are important?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Right, and they're all meant to be completely unite as a single operational unit and not pulled apart.
Correct.
And so this is the thing, is that is basically that Da'at is the only thing that's pulled apart. These things aren't actually pulled apart. This is in the mind. But because the power of the mind is as it is, the Da'at being where it's at and creating this gulf is what allows for this compartmentalization to take place, which is the purpose, which is where we get all this shit out of, you know, to something that's standing something in the way.
Yeah. Were you able to see this emanation image?
I'm very familiar with it. It's from the Sefer Yetzirah. I can actually send you a really, maybe I'll scan it or something, but I have a really cool translation of the Sefer Yetzirah where they explain this really well.
I'd be very interested. Yeah, I find, like, basically... This, you know, this sort of has an almost, if you hear how, like, Atlantis was constructed, you know, the sort of different circular channels. But just for me, this, there's just a lot here. But, you know, looking at you know, my thing is I'm very much right now fixated on this idea of, perhaps circumambulation, Catherine wheels, cycles of time. This is a very important thing for me. And I came across this image, and I really liked the idea that it took these things and sort of made it into a similar imagery. Another thing I thought was interesting is that essentially, it's creating a symmetrical image, and yet it's still the same way that Malkuth sort of throws off the symmetry. This one sort of connecting line not going all the way through throws off the symmetry in the same way. So I thought it was interesting that it had a lot of the same design concepts. But so if you have something on this, I'd be really interested in it.
Yeah, it says actually Ain Sof. It has two Ains. So the Ain is on the right side and Sof is on the other. That's what it is written there, if you're interested. I can't see close enough to see what all the rest say, but yeah.
Well, it says here these are the emanation of the Sephiroth, so I'm assuming these are sort of like
I think so. I just can't look close
Yeah, I
enough.
know. It's not. I couldn't find a better image than this. But I think.
But yeah, no, I can find it actually. Maybe in a second, but yeah.
But I think it's basically would be the different spheres.
Well, that's how they're described, is as like basically this telescope, but then at the same time, the tree is within every part,
Well,
within every
exactly. This is your
sphere.
sort of astrological alignment you mentioned of sort of the tree being folded in on itself. I would imagine is almost something like this, where each sphere is sort of, I guess, eclipsing the next one. And if you see, it's almost like a sun in the background. It's sort of like a full astrological alignment of all your spheres in a row.
So there's this idea too that what the acknowledgement is for the Babylonians with the sun square and 666 is that everything came from the sun and everything returns to the sun. And their idea is that the only time that you have, basically everything is back to a static state, because everything is absolutely counterbalanced and the tree isn't broken apart, is when the fucking sun swallows everything again. And so everything in the meantime, it's just we do the best we can. And so that's the rationale for Babylon, is that you build it in the name because you have it. And so why wouldn't you use it? But in doing so, you basically take what's most precious or what's most sacred and you whore it out. Which I think is like, I think that there's an issue there. It's because people, I think it's the wrong relationship to knowledge in the first place, and that when you relate to things from a certain hierarchical standpoint in terms of the idea of progress and what it means to what it takes to survive, I think it comes down to this basic thing that's the beginning of 2001, with the ape hitting the other ape, the fucking Cain and Abel scene, is this notion of what it comes down to, of cooperation or survival of the fittest. Do we survive through cooperating, or do we survive by dog eat dog? Serious A, serious B. Even though serious A and serious B are completely mutually interdependent and rely upon each other. And our sun moves supposedly, I guess, with Sirius around this galactic center, in the same way that our Earth moves with our moon around the sun, which is like our version of the center. So it seems like everything, if you're gonna take like Crowley's idea that we're where he got the rationale for saying "do what thou wilt," is that he saw stars having these what do you call it? Rotations, or they had their pathways, right, that the star goes in. But we know to a degree that he that was an assessment at the time. That wasn't actually the way that things are. But at the same time, you can definitely recognize that, that there's an interdependence. It's like the basis of Buddhism. It's like you don't want to miss that point. You miss that point, and then it changes everything. So I don't, I disagree with some of the main premises of Mystery Babylon, as far as I am able to recognize. And I don't feel that way with knowledge, that why would you want to do that with knowledge in the first place? Yet at the same time, I could recognize, even in myself, when I fucking put my blog together and my name isn't attributed to it, or it's mixed up into a heap of other people's info, I want to distinguish. I want to be like, no, these are my thoughts, And then we have why the fucking whole copyright thing and all this stuff. Where is that really coming from? And does it have anything to do with, like, beyond us looking for reference points in order to localize our sense of self, which is completely holographic and has no basis in reality, the same way that Babylon is in the first place, as being completely holographic and having no basis in reality? So, anyways.